This is the Education Gadfly Show.
He is shockingly old.
I am shockingly old.
Yeah, are you old? No, you're not older than me, I don't think.
Yeah.
Let's just get off this topic quickly.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Tim Tebow of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Ow. I don't even, what are you trying to say there, Bib?
You could take that in so many different ways. And in any way you take it, it's probably not a very good analogy. You're not really known for your religiosity or your public displays thereof. But you are an icon, though.
I'm not that clean cut.
Yeah.
I like to think I don't fold under pressure like that bad boy did.
Were you homeschooled as a child?
I was not. I like to think of myself as the Rob Gronkowski of Ed Policy.
I don't even know who that is.
Monster Patriots tight end, baby.
Oh,
monster,
yeah?
Patriots, uh-huh, tight end.
Uh-huh. Well, you got to put on some more pounds if that's going to be you.
I'm heavy enough. I just got to get taller.
Nice.
And
hey,
faster.
I miss you, Rick. It's been a while.
I miss you, baby.
You've been gallivanting about the country as usual.
Yeah, around the country. We got down to South America for a couple weeks. That was pretty cool.
Nice.
How about you?
Did you check out the school reform in Argentina?
Very little. Very little. We did check out New Year's in Rio. Which was pretty cool.
Was that fun?
It was a scene. 2 million people on the beach. It's a lot of people.
That's awesome. Well, you've missed a lot while you've been gone. Education policy moves on without you, Rick Hess.
Hard to imagine.
So we're going to cover lots of things today. We'll play Pardon the Gadfly, Amber's Research Minute, Chris's What's Up With That. So let's get started. Ty's here. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Since the last time the two of you were together, House Republicans released two bills to reauthorize the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Many Democratic reform groups decried the bills as a big step backwards for reform and for poor kids. Are they right?
No.
Yeah, they're not right. They might be right.
They're wrong.
Or not.
I'm a big fan of the House bill. Big
All right. Fan. So you wrote a blog post, very short, pithy blog post.
For me, especially.
I know, exactly. from the AEI blog, saying there were six things you liked about this bill. And basically everything you liked was that they were undoing the overreach of No Child Left Behind.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so you like it from a federalism perspective. But what do you say to the people on the left? You say, hey, you know, you're just wiping out all the safeguards that were in the law for poor minority kids. big hater.
Which safeguards do they have in mind?
Well, you know, the focus on disaggregated data, holding schools accountable for the achievement of subgroups, including kids with disabilities, English language learners, minorities, all of it, you know, not to mention highly qualified teachers. Da, da, da. Look, you and I agree on a lot of this stuff, but, you know, the argument that I hear you making and is mostly, hey, this is a better and more appropriate federal role.
Mm-hmm.
But aren't you worried at a pragmatic level that this is going to lead a lot of states and schools to go back to the old way of doing things, sweeping their achievement gaps under the rug?
Oh, I mean, I think dumb federal policy that's well-intentioned doesn't do a lot of good for anybody. So the fact that the ideas were nice doesn't make up for the fact that there are things the federal government is not equipped to do well. And, you know, I think disaggregation for transparency purposes is terrific. And the House bill retains those.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and ensuring that you don't steer Title I dollars away from Title I schools seems appropriate. Mm-hmm. And the House bill protects that. But getting the federal government in the business of identifying or telling states how to identify low performing schools based particularly on subgroups has fed what I've called achievement gap mania, which I think is unhelpful. And having the feds try to dictate interventions for low-performing schools,
mm-hmm,
I think has, you know, whether you call it a comprehensive school reform or, you know, the NCLB remedies, proven remarkably ineffectual.
So why do you think they included teacher evaluation in this package? I mean, it was totally out of character. They're gonna decentralize, devolve everything, except create a new federal mandate on teacher evaluation.
I assume Jeb made a phone call or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally have no idea.
Maybe Michelle made a phone call. You know, some people have thought that maybe they just want to poke the unions in the eye. And that thing's going to get stripped out.
That'll get stripped out. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting because it actually gives them a chip.
Mm-hmm.
But look, I mean, they totally blow up highly qualified teacher,
amen,
which I think is a remarkably smart move.
Absolutely.
They actually, you know, go after maintenance of effort in a really healthy and constructive way. Which I think is terrific. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot to like in this bill.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that that everybody's cards are on the table now, as I wrote last week, and now it's time for us to hammer out a deal. And I don't think it's impossible. It won't happen this year because people can't work together this year. But I think next year you're going to see something that looks a lot like Lamar Alexander's bill become law, which is somewhere between the Harkin-Enzi proposal and this House GOP proposal. And we'll be the better for it. Okay, topic number two.
Both New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and NYC Mayor Michael Bloomberg have taken on teacher unions in the past 2 weeks. Are they bullying teachers, as some have said, or calling for reasonable reforms?
They're not bullying teachers. They're, you know, what they're calling for is perfectly sensible. The idea that teachers ought to be evaluated, that you ought to figure out which teachers are doing better and maybe pay them better, that teachers in lousy schools who are lousy teachers ought to not be teaching. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is now. It is true, I think, that they're also grandstanding, and some of the rhetoric is predictably kind of vapid and silly. I guess, Bloomberg was talking about being opposed to entrenched. One of them was talking about being opposed to entrenched interests, mm-hmm. and a lobbyist for the kids, mm-hmm. and all this kind of language that makes my stomach a little fluttery.
Now, Rick, okay, you and I have both said, and we just talked about this, where we don't think the federal government can do a whole lot constructive here. But here you have, on two different issues in New York, action that you could say is precipitated by federal pressure. On the one hand, Mayor Bloomberg talking about overhauling a bunch of failing schools in order to get the SIGMA money flowing. And then there's an impasse on teacher evaluations, and the state said you're not going to get your Race to the Top money unless you get rigorous evaluations in place. And so again, like for a Joe Williams of Democrats for Education Reform, let's say, who works nationally and in New York, how do you make the case to Joe that the federal role is not helping him push for reform in New York City?
Well, so there's a question of what kind of reform to get out of this. And what I would argue is a lot of what has been pushed forward by Race to the Top enthusiasm, say, is crudely devised, overwritten state-level legislation, which we are actually going to regret because it is placing more weight on these teacher evaluation metrics than is justified at this point, which is one thing, right? I mean, this is the problem. It's not the federal government can't make people do things. It's that what they can make people do things, but can't make them do them well. So you can get crude or poorly written. Yes, we wrote that a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And you keep forgetting it. Seems like that,
I don't forget it.
So that's one thing. A second thing is the fact that Cuomo and Bloomberg are scrambling now to get New York to live up to its commitments after it was one of the vaunted dozen to pick up Race to the Top money is, I think, telling about exactly, every state that won Race to the Top dollars is now out of compliance. I mean, that tells us something about how the fidelity to which states are going to live up to their promises. And yes, sick. We spent $3.5 billion, and some of that money is inevitably going to nudge states to do something about low performing schools. Mm-hmm. But, I feel real comfortable saying that I think when we stand back in 3 years, mm-hmm. I will feel comfortable saying that the SIG investment was exactly as pointless as the comprehensive school reform investment turned out to be.
We're going to have to see. I think SIG could be one of those sleeper issues that could be raised in the election. I mean, this is just a huge waste of money just to do something feel good. And we had this debate back in the year 2000 between Bush and Gore about what to do about failing schools. It might be good to reboot that debate once again.
But now you can't. No, but wait a minute. But you just suggested that SIG actually is not a $3.5 billion waste of money, but it's actually helping to drive and create room for
just interviewing you and being the devil's advocate, Rick. Come on, it's a total waste of money. Though it has led to grandstanding in New York.
What do you say to Joe Williams when he says, "Wait a minute, isn't this helping drive states to do the right thing?"
I think it's tough. I think the federal intervention always has the potential to provide political cover for the good guys. And so you want to figure out a way to keep that while getting rid of all the stuff that leads to the negative outcome. So that's why, Race to the Top, for all of its problems, I think is a much better policy, since it's at least competition, it's incentives, not mandates, than something where say, D for wants to mandate a certain approach to school accountability for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, topic number three.
On Monday, the National Center for Science Education claimed that not teaching climate change is akin to leaving evolution out of science class. Should global warming be taught as fact in every school, or is this politicizing the curriculum?
I think these guys sound like, they're picking a silly fight. It partly depends what you mean by climate change. If we're talking that the students ought to learn that there are ways to measure temperatures and temperature variation over time, and that changes in this stuff is going to have an impact on climate conditions, that's fine.
If changes in climate, it's going to have a impact on climate conditions.
Oh, excuse me.
See, you're tongue-tied, Rick, and you know why? Because you're wrong on this one.
No.
So dead wrong on this.
But I mean, if they want kids taught that they need to watch, you know, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, because you know, one set of partisans is absolutely right on this, and there's that strikes me as absolutely politicizing science.
All right.
Education.
So look, this is tricky here, but I don't think it's impossible. They absolutely earth sciences class.
You're tongue-tied, Mike.
That's a tough issue. In the earth sciences class, I don't see how you teach earth science, for example, and not get into the issue of global warming. It's a huge issue. It's a part of what's happening on our planet. I think there's overwhelming scientific evidence that the climate is changing rapidly and that human activity over the last 100 years has contributed to that. Now, where the science gets very fuzzy is on what to do about it, whether any of the solutions that environmentalists have proposed would make a dent or not. And so I think you want to teach up to that first line, which is that there's this thing called the climate change. Here's what the science shows. Human activity has been shown to make this happen. I think to not teach that to kids is really irresponsible. Then you got to be really careful not to go the next step and politicize it, and therefore, you know, say, ergo, students, you need to go out and write to your congressman and support of a cap and trade.
Well, look,
system.
I mean, I personally find the arguments for climate change, for man-made climate change, pretty compelling. So that's fine. But we're not talking about what I would like to see kids brainwashed to do. The reality is that science frequently, right, the scientific process frequently leads to wrinkles and even changing its mind, right? What we know about whether it's good, healthy or unhealthy to drink wine, what we know is healthy or unhealthy in terms of eating habits, these things have all changed pretty substantially back and forth over the last 25, 30 years.
Yeah, but we still have health class. And
we still have health class.
We tell the kids the best sign thing that we know at the time.
Well, I mean, that's actually right. I mean, when we're actually getting into trying to prescribe kids, tell kids what they should and should not eat based upon science of changes, I don't know. That's an interesting one. This strikes me as highly politicized, and I don't know this National Center for Science Education at all, but it strikes me that for them to present it this way, that it's akin to leaving evolution out of the curriculum, strikes me that they are very explicitly trying to politicize the issue. And we know, for instance, that folks who think evolution belongs in the curriculum don't mean that it should be a subject of debate. Mm-hmm. They mean that it should be taught as a truism, mm-hmm. and as a foundation. If these folks mean that the man-made climate change needs to be taught as a truism, and that a unit of science instruction needs to be what do we do about it, in terms of, that strikes me as very obviously political.
Then we agree about that one. Hey, I do want to get a plug in for everybody to know that this is a very green podcast that we run here. We print minimal amount of paper. We turn off the heat and air conditioning when we're taping the show.
And so, in fact, we sit on a green bamboo shoot chair.
Yes, that's
which
exactly
are
right.
Replenished.
They're not very comfortable.
No.
But we do it anyways. That's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Isn't it fun to have Rick back?
So much fun.
Brings
so
a smile to our faces.
It's fun to be back.
You know, Rick's got a birthday coming up.
You do? I did not know.
Getting old.
He is shockingly old.
I am shockingly old.
Yeah, are you old? No, you're not older than me, I don't think.
Yeah.
Let's just get off this topic quickly.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You are a little bit, like 1.5 years,
yeah.
maybe?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Rick's age starts with a 4.
Yeah, me and Amber used to be much younger together.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Yeah.
It's because you go way, way back.
Uh-huh.
All right, Amber, this is going to be a good one. I'm excited. A blockbuster study.
Yes, lots to talk about.
Today?
It is the new supersized analysis of teacher effectiveness and value added, conducted by a trio of respected economists. That would be Chetty, Rockoff, and Friedman, showing that the impact of good teachers follows students into adulthood. Researchers gleaned data in one large urban district, comprising 18 million test scores from roughly 2.5 million kids spanning over 2 decades, and find that most of the bias in value-added estimates is eliminated by controlling for prior student test scores and various demographic data. They examine changes in teaching staff and find that when high value-added teachers, the top 5%, join the school, end-of-year test scores rise immediately in the grade taught by that teacher, and when they leave, scores fall, and the size of the gain or loss matches what the analysts predict based on the teacher's value added. Hope we got all that. They also track a subset of students, those who graduated in 2008 into adulthood. This was so impressive. They used income tax forms, W-2 forms, university tuition payments, Social Security forms, and so on, and found that the pupils assigned to teachers with higher value added are more likely to attend college, earn higher salaries, live in better neighborhoods, and save money more for retirement. I could go on and on, but I think, you know, the last little factoid I'll throw out is replacing a good teacher whose value added is in the bottom 5%. So this is a Hanischek thing. With an average teacher would increase the lifetime income of that teacher's class by an average of about $250,000 combined. One little tiny thing, they weren't able to control for family connections when they link the value-added estimates to earnings, so that part of the analysis is a little bit more of a leap than the value-added, in my opinion, but still incredibly impressive, and it obviously advances our knowledge about stellar teachers.
Wow. So a couple of thoughts. First of all, I really liked a piece that Kevin Carey wrote about this, saying that, you know, that sure, that all the news has been about teacher quality, but really this is more fundamentally about test scores, you know, that you can show that these value-added gains on test scores are linked to things in the real world, like kids going on to get better paying jobs and not go to prison and make more money, things that we all care about. And,
right.
You know, this has been somewhat of an open question. I mean, to me at least, that, you know, to the degree to which the focus on student achievement is linked to stuff that matters in the real world. And I think it's important to have that evidence out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of the pushback to this is what? I mean, we've got Weinrip in the New York Times saying, well, these data are old. And they're from the pre-accountability era, so it would play out differently now.
Right.
I mean, you think that has any...
Sure. I mean, right. There's a couple interesting things here, right? I mean, one, at a glib level, it's kind of interesting, right? At one level, we kind of all need to act as if we believe teachers have a big impact on kids' long-term outcomes, because otherwise we wouldn't be spending any of our energy worrying about this. So at one level, all this really does is reassure us that we haven't been just totally wasting our time.
Parking up the wrong tree.
So that's what. But the second, I think your point, and I guess Kevin's point, that look, test scores do seem to link the things we care about. It is true, and it is true, and that's what's powerful and interesting here. But one, I mean, Weinrip's concern is valid. If in an accountability era, teachers are behaving in ways that drive up test scores by taking time away from activities which previously would have developed student ability to delay gratification or student discipline.
Or teaching to the test.
If they're doing these things, then you would not necessarily expect the full range of benefits that you saw in that earlier area,
right,
where teachers were just naturally, you know, high value added teachers were just naturally generating these things, is part and parcel of what they were doing. It's an interesting kind of open question. The other thing is I haven't read the study, so I honestly
multiple hours to do it.
Okay, so I can't speak to this, but I do wonder. I mean, I just think there's a lot of interesting possible spurious relationships here when you're getting into looking at value added and classroom assignment and long term effects, and it seems, I mean, it does just seem really impressive to me that they were able to draw links between 1 year bumps in value added scores and substantial life outcomes that we really care about. And if true, that's compelling. But I just think over time, we're going to see people going and looking at these linkages and seeing if there might be some complexities at work that they weren't able to fully answer.
Yeah, I mean, selection effects, right?
Yeah.
That there's something about the kids' social capital or background that helps them do better on the tests and do better in these other respects.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying about the earnings. You know, that's where you can't really look at those family connections piece. But in the value added, they had data from the parent characteristics from the tax data forms, which, you know, we don't have, and those are strong predictors of test scores. So they were able to sort of omit those from the value-added models, and then basically they found that they weren't correlated with the value-added on the things that they could observe, except conditional, basically on the way they fit the model. So bottom line, they had this sort of tax form data on parent characteristics that they could manipulate in and out of the model to kind of get at that sorting.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, like I said, I mean, at one level, kind of glibly, that we kind of all act as if we think this stuff matters anyway. And second, that there's these interesting questions, which I haven't had a chance to really think about deeply. But, I mean, it's just a really impressive and serious piece of work. And to go and assemble those kinds of data sources is something most researchers don't have the patience or energy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. I mean, this is just, you know, these guys really deserve, credit and really deserve credit for being willing to put this much ingenuity and effort into figuring this out.
Yeah, huge lift.
An Education Gadfly Show podcast shout out for these three economists.
Boom.
Woohoo. All right. Well, as our listeners may recall, we no longer do songs related to the Research Minute. Instead, we do a weekly pop quiz.
That's right. So last week's pop quiz was, what percentage of Indiana's total state budget is allocated to K-12 education? Our options were A, 25%, B, 43%, C, 56%, or D, 63%. And Rick says?
11%.
That was not in my answer. You have to play better. This is our new game from now on. So
okay.
Behave. 25, 43, 56, or 63 for Indiana's allotment to their K-12 education.
I'm gonna go with 43 because it's one lower than John Riggins' uniform number.
There you go.
I'm going with 63.
And neither one of you are right. It is 56%.
Boom. Although I got to say, to make it a better game, don't put the answer on my material sheet next time.
Yeah, likewise. We didn't think it would be fair to use that
shoot.
To guess the right one.
Okay, sorry. What would you guys have really guessed? Come on, would you have really guessed?
I probably would have guessed 40. I mean, most states it would be, somewhere around 50%, I think, is most states, right? 40 to 50% is state budget?
Yeah, ballpark. I'm in a Patriots mood this week. I would have either gone 12 for Brady. Or 87 for Gronk.
I'm serious about you behaving on my poll question from now on. 50% of voters answered the question correctly, by the way.
Okay, so, Amber, what you got for this week?
This week, and this is an easy one, so don't say the answer. What percentage of first-year undergraduate students took remedial courses in 07-08? A, 12%, B, 19%, C, 27%, D, 36%. Our listeners can cast their vote online at www.edexcellence.net/podcast. And I'll let you know the answer next week.
Here's what's happening on edexcellence.net this week. What can Ohio learn from the Louisiana Recovery School District? Terry Ryan uses this question in Fordham's new report on the topic to consider how Ohio might approach its most troubled schools and districts. If the state is to consider new forms of governance and management, what might alternatives look like? Visit the Ohio Gadfly Daily today to read more about it. Martin Luther King Day will always bring to mind the fight for equality. On the Board's Eye View blog, Peter Meyer highlights Dr. King's enduring call for rigorous, comprehensive, and liberating education in our country. On the Common Core Watch blog, Kathleen Porter McGee reviews Beverly Jobrack's recent book, The Tyranny of the Textbook. An insider exposes how educational materials undermine reform, and concludes that on their own, neither structural reform nor changes to curriculum and instruction will greatly improve student achievement. Read those articles and more on the Education Gadfly Daily. Reserve your spot at the next edition of Fordham Live. On February 1st at 4 p.m., UVA's Dan Willingham, NCTQ's Kate Walsh, and our very own Kathleen Porter McGee and Ann Jones of Project Lead the Way will discuss this crucial question: what's holding back America's science performance? Join us as Checker Finn moderates this debate based on the State of State Science Standards 2012. Fordham will be releasing this at the end of January. If you are unable to attend, the event will be broadcast live at 4 p.m. All this happening on edexcellence.net. Join the conversation today.
Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that. What up with that? Yes,
Chris, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. How's it going, guys?
Have we celebrated some of the stunning Michigan victories lately?
I don't think we have.
No. First of all, we won one of those bowls.
BCS Bowl, yes.
Yeah, which one was it?
The Sugar Bowl.
The Sugar Bowl, baby. Sugar.
Mike, I think you're not hitting the threshold, which you've got to be engaged in order to kind of partake
oh, yeah?
in the win.
Is that right? Was this organic sugar bowl? Do they use raw sugar? Or is this processed?
Sugar in the raw, I think, in those brown packages. Yeah.
Okay, good. And are there sugar tariffs involved or not? Because I don't feel good about that. All right, anyways, we won the Sugar Bowl, and then we just beat Michigan State in basketball.
Yes, Woo-hoo. We did.
Mike, I think you're restricted to chanting go medium blue.
Go medium
blue. Until you've kind of brought yourself up to the big blue.
You know, our fill-in interim producer/intern Lisa went to Michigan State. the team that we smashed the other night.
By one point.
Okay. All right, Chris, what you got for us this week?
Well, I should start by giving a fair warning that the contents of this week's edition of What's Up With That are a bit on the graphic side. That being said, I guess I'll dive right in. 75-year-old Paul LeDuc, a teacher at Schaumburg Christian in the northwest Chicago suburbs, has been charged with the sexual exploitation of a child after a student reported to a teacher that they saw LeDuc masturbating while seated at his podium. Mind you, the student observed this, along with 20-some others, as they were seated in the class LeDuc was teaching.
How do you sit at a podium?
What's up with that? I mean, seriously. I've had teachers in the past that have the tall podiums and maybe like a bar stool type chair behind the podium, but I mean, it really just bewilders me that nobody had caught this guy before. The report goes on to say, after investigators looked into the incident, that LeDuc had been doing this multiple times a year for over 10 years. And this was the first time he was caught at Schaumburg. They looked into it. They fired him. But for over 10 years, this was going on.
Wow. What's up with that?
Seriously. And I've got you two speechless. So, you know.
This is the same. We have this problem all the time. I mean, once a month, you come in with one of these sexual abuse stories, and they're just not funny. So we're not sure where to go with them. It's sick and wrong, especially, you know, look, as a parent now, you know, you start to think about these stories and you just want to beat somebody up.
Yes. I'm glad they fired the guy.
Yeah, that's the one nice thing about this is that it didn't get, swamped down in bureaucracy. But then again, mind you, this was a private school, so.
So I guess that's our policy takeaway. One more reason to support vouchers is because private schools can fire masturbating teachers.
But, well, sorry for the lack of humor this week, guys. But, you know, after reading this one, all I could say was, what's up with that?
That's insane.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank goodness. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And remember, if you like what you heard during the podcast, head to edexcellence.net/podcast to find links and more about this episode. You can, by the way, now listen to just the segment you want to listen to. That's right. You can just listen to Amber and get rid of Rick and me. That's very sad for us. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.